Welcome to the 91st episode of InfectioPod, a podcast in which we regularly discuss about pathogens, conditions, and current research topics in infectious diseases. We are three physicians from Hamburg, Germany, practicing in infectious diseases, and our names are Annette Hennix, Elena Terhalle, and myself, Till Koch. We are supported by the DZIF, the German Center for Infection Research. If you have any questions or suggestions, please write us to info@infectsupport.de or at infectsupport in all these social networks. So this one is a bit of a special episode, first and foremost because we do it in English. We don't do this normally. All our other episodes are usually in German. But the reason why we are recording this in English is that we have a very special guest on the episode. Pranita Tama is joining us today, and we are really delighted to have her. She's an associate professor in pediatrics in the Division of Pediatrics Infectious Diseases at the Johns Hopkins University, and she's also the first author of the IDSA guidance on the treatment of antimicrobial resistance of gram-negative infections. This was both for the editions for 2024 and also for the previous year, 2023. And yeah, she's just a fantastic speaker, and we were very happy that she can join us on this episode. On previous episodes of this podcast, specifically on the episodes 86 and 87, we have covered this guidance document from the IDSA in length. And yeah, I also wanted to give a shout out to this fantastic other podcast, Febrile, that also has covered this guidance in depth, and where Pranita Tama also joined as a guest in the past. On the 87th episode of our podcast, InfectSupport, we discussed the management of antimicrobial resistant gram-negative infections, and specifically also of Stenotrophomonas maltophilia infections. We discussed several topics, such as the difficulty in the disambiguation between infection and disease. So is it really a disease, or is it just bystander detection of a pathogen in very sick patients? And yeah, those are obviously very important points in clinical practice. But we also discussed general principles of therapy, and here we noted some pretty big differences between our own practice in Germany and the recommendations that were issued in the guidance. These involved basically the use of dual therapy, so to routinely recommend to use two drugs, and then also the order in which these drugs were recommended. Specifically in Germany, we usually start with TMP-sulfa, so what we call cotrimoxazole, or what's called Bactrim in the US. So yeah, these were some points where our practice differed really a lot from the guidance, how we read it. And this was not the case in the other 5 points of the guidance. So for this topic of Stenotrophomonas maltophilia management, we reached out to Pranita and asked her if she would be willing to come on the podcast and discuss with us our very detailed, very nerdy, specific questions to the Stenotrophomonas management. And we are really super happy that she's here for the episode.
Okay, so Pranita, thank you very much for being on the podcast. Maybe you can start with the case that you brought today.
Yeah, thank you all for having me. This is very nice and an honor to be part of the podcast. Since I'm a pediatrician, I thought I would maybe start with just as a discussion point, a case and a child. And this is actually a child I took care of last year. It's a one-month-old with a congenital cardiac condition called transposition of the great arteries, where the pulmonary artery, the aorta, are switched at birth. And usually day 5, there's a surgery to switch them back. But this child, unfortunately, did quite poorly after the surgery and was awaiting a cardiac transplant. And about day 30, the baby developed bacteremia with Stenotrophomonas maltophilia and continued to have positive cultures from day 30 to day 37. During this time, initially the baby was quite ill, very hypotensive, so they actually chose a pretty broad drug, meropenem, which is broader than we usually pick in our ICU. But then once the Stenotrophomonas recovered, as we usually do, we switched to trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, commonly called Bactrim, as monotherapy, and that's usually how we practiced. And we continued that, but despite us switching out the lines and catheters that could potentially be infected, so all the potential sources, all the source control we could identify, the baby stayed on Trimsulfa for 5 days, was persistently positive blood cultures. We actually, we don't typically do broth microdilution for clinical specimens, but we actually tested to make sure it was susceptible. It was susceptible, all the isolates. And then after about almost 7 days, we stopped the Trimsulfa and we switched to sulfitoricol. And the baby actually had no further positive blood cultures and did very well. Received about 10 days of sulfitoricol with no positive blood cultures subsequently. And the child has went on to receive the heart transplant, and which is all very good. So I don't know if you had questions about this or if you wanted to, me to talk more about my thoughts on what the problems might have been.
Yeah, I actually have a question because I read that the child was on ECMO, and we also have these patients, of course, with ECMO in our cardiac ICU. I'm an adult physician, so I don't see the babies, fortunately. But it's always the thing that these cannulas can't be exchanged easily. So was it in this child's case, could you also exchange the ECMO cannulas, or was it just the central lines and everything?
It's a very good question. There was one cannula that could not be exchanged.
Okay. Yeah.
It was too risky. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like you
sure,
said.
Yeah.
So it was more femoral lines, even arterial lines, all the other sorts of catheters. But yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is a problem, of course, with ECMO, that there's never really, I should have said source control, but it's never complete.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's also always the discussion that we're having with the ICU physician. We always very, do source control and change everything. And they say, we can't do that. And exactly. I was wondering, did the child like clinically improve with the Trimsulfa? And was it just the positive blood culture that persisted, or was there still like ongoing infection clinically?
Yeah, it's always a little hard to tell because we're giving so many pressors and there's just a lot of confounding things happening for such
Absolutely,
a sick baby.
Yeah.
But I was involved pretty closely in this child's care, and the baby was very hypothermic, went from needing three pressors to not needing, basically needing a tiny amount of pressors after. So I would say that the baby was actually quite clinically ill. The lungs looked surprisingly okay. So I think that this most likely came from one of the catheters, but and an N of one is never enough to say one drug is good or not good, right?
Yeah.
Our go-to generally is Trimsulfa, and before sulfitoricol came along, or aztreonam, avibactam, it always was, and I struggle a lot because I, as a stewardship person, I don't want to unnecessarily use broader drugs if I don't need to. I think the downstream developing new resistance to these drugs, obviously these drugs are quite costly. There's multiple reasons why I would love to avoid them. But we have had, I often think of, for us at least, when we think about Stenotrophomonas, there's distinguishing colonization infection is always tricky, particularly wounds and respiratory tracts, as we all know. I think in the blood, we tend to treat it, but we definitely have patients who have a catheter. We remove the catheter. They look really good. And for those patients, I still often try to use something like Trimsulfa. Simply because, I don't want to give every Stenotrophomonas a drug like sulfitoricol. But I do think there's a cohort of patients, whether it's, some of the neutropenic patients with hemorrhagic pneumonias, they often do, at least from my experience, tend to be oncology patients a lot, who do get incredibly ill. It's in they're hemodynamically unstable. The blood culture grows Stenotrophomonas. And I think as we've sort of been delving more into the history of Trimsulfa it's made me realize, and how I practice in our institution, so for our stewardship kind of local guidelines, is we have this sort of stratification of, you know, really critically ill that seems likely from the infection, where we would consider a newer drug like sufentanil or aztreonam avibactam. And I should note, in the U.S., aztreonam avibactam is not yet approved mm-hmm. by our Food and Drug Administration, so we still do the combination of ceftazidime-aztreonam. Mm-hmm. And then for most of the other cases, which is still the vast majority of Stenotrophomonas, if we think they need some treatment, because of course many need nothing, I would still suggest Trimsulfa, probably as monotherapy, and that's something we've written in our local guidelines, even though I know that's in conflict with IDSA guidelines.
Yeah, okay, that's very interesting to hear you clarify this, because this is something that we really kind of stumbled over when we read the recent guidance, which was, I mean, it is very nuancedly phrased, I would say, like the guidance also says that there is like a lack of data in a lot of areas, but still this was a bit different from how we used to practice or how we are practicing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was just wondering if you could go through the pharmacological PKPD data for Trimsulfa and why you would prefer the newer drugs over. Because I think what you really nicely, as Till said, is, you know, to differentiate really between the very sick ones that might need it. And I went through the guidance day before yesterday and looked at all the original papers, which is mostly like, you know, in vitro data or animal data, and there's no clinical trials. And it's also difficult with these patients. There are so many confounders. You can't really tell what's a drug effect and what is what. But yeah, I mean, I think there's some indicators that the newer drugs might be more powerful than the Trimsulfa. So maybe you could elaborate a bit on that.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll start with just thinking about the breakpoints, mm-hmm. Trimsulfa and Stenotrophomonas as a background. You know, the U.S. FDA, so whenever in the United States, when a drug gets approved by the FDA, so your equivalent of the EMA, mm-hmm. the FDA also, as part of the process, reviews the proposed breakpoints by the manufacturer and approves those if they agree. So interestingly, for when you look at the package label for Trimsulfa, it doesn't mention Stenotrophomonas. There's never been breakpoints, so the FDA never had breakpoints. Recently, they re-reviewed the data, decided we don't have enough data that this drug actually kills Stenotrophomonas, basically. It's unable to achieve at least a one-log kill, which is used as a standard. Mm-hmm. So it actually still doesn't have breakpoints. The CLSI has a breakpoint of 2 micrograms per mL or less. Recently, within the last 2 years, they re-reviewed the data. It was very contentious because the data, and I'll talk through the PKPD data, pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic data, suggest that at best you might be able to achieve stasis with Trimsulfa, which we think of sometimes as maybe okay for an uncomplicated cystitis, but for invasive infections, again, CLSI, FDA really likes to see at least a one-log kill to say, yes, we feel like this drug could kill bacteria that's causing serious infections. And then UCAST has a breakpoint, but it's extremely low. It's a bit lower than what could be achieved. So essentially for UCAST, mm-hmm. it's almost like an intermediate-only yes. breakpoint. So for CLSI, I should just mention, they didn't remove the breakpoint completely because there was discussion about doing that, because there's many parts of the world, being an international group, where they don't have access to drugs like sulfitrocol, ceftazavir, aztreonam. They decided, let's keep Trimsulfa, but put a comment that if you're going to use it, it really should be a component of combination therapy. Not because we really have data that combination therapy is better, but a little bit of desperation when we know this drug does not appear to kill this bacteria. It feels like it could be harmful to give people, clinicians, confidence that it works alone. Mm-hmm. So I'll talk through the PKPD data. There's been several of these very nice models. The one I'll kind of talk through that I like, but there's several like this. The last name of the first author is Lasko, L-A-S-K-O. It was published in Antimicrobial Agents Chemotherapy 2022. And they did this very nice study where they had these in vitro models, as you mentioned. Unfortunately, we're pretty limited to preclinical data, animal models, PKPD data. But in this model, they gave human simulated dose. They used human simulated dosages of 20 milligrams per kilogram a day of Trimsulfa. So a very large dose, much larger than any of us will probably be giving in our practice. And what they did is they had a series of time curves. Usually these are organized, the y-axis is bacterial growth, x-axis is time. They had, of course, a control, and then they looked at trimethoprim MICs, 0.25, 1, 2. Based on the CLSI, those would all be considered, quote, susceptible to Trimsulfa, trimethoprim MIC of 2 or less. What they found was with E. coli, an E. coli that was had an MIC of 0.25 or 1 or 2, trimethoprim had this against the E. coli, the E. coli had a several log kill. With MIC of 0.25, for example, it went down 4 logs, maybe 3 logs for 1, maybe 2 logs for MIC of 2. But you certainly see killing of E. coli. And when the trimethoprim MIC was 4, which is not susceptible, the E. coli, there was no stasis or killing. But with Stenotrophomonas in the same model, you see a basically horizontal line that there's some stasis, but there's not any killing. There was no, even for these very, very low MICs of 0.25, there was no log reduction in Stenotrophomonas. So there's been several of these kind of in vitro studies. And as you very nicely said, because there has been no clinical trials looking at Trimsulfa for steno, the observational studies have issues like, is this colonization infection? Because often respiratory bloods are combined. There's a difference between a patient with a catheter where the catheter's pulled, they do great, versus a very neutropenic patient with Stenotrophomonas who might be quite ill. Often, as was the case with the baby I mentioned, there's a few days delay in starting active therapy because most of the time we don't add drugs like Trimsulfa up front. So there's all sorts of problems with the observational data, clinical data. So we're forced to rely on these preclinical studies. But one other study I just wanted to mention is a rabbit model. The first author's last name is Petraitis, P-E-T-R-A-I-T-I-S, also published Antimicrobial Agents Chemotherapy 2022. And this is a neutropenic rabbit model where when none of these rabbits received, they were all infected with Stenotrophomonas. When none of them received an antibiotic, all 8 rabbits died. When they received sulfitoricol, the 8 rabbits that received sulfitoricol, 87% survived. But the 8 that received human simulated dosages of Trimsulfa, only 25% survived. Again, it's an animal model. Of course, it's not human data, but suggesting that Trimsulfa may not be the best drug for this organism. Now, I think an important point to make is these are neutropenic rabbits. What we don't know is maybe if you have a functioning, a healthy immune system with Stenotrophomonas, whatever Trimsulfa is able to do, maybe the immune system does the rest and it's okay, right? So it's very possible that's the case. But this does make me concerned with some of these severely neutropenic patients who appear to be quite sick with Stenotrophomonas to say with confidence Trimsulfa is okay. I mean, certainly if it was a family member and I had access to a drug like sulfitoricol, I'd feel better. And I will say with I should mention, I have no conflicts of interest or disclosures with any company. So I definitely am not trying to sell sulfitoricol. what I'll say is there's actually never been a clinical isolate of Stenotrophomonas anywhere in the world resistant to sulfitoricol. In fact, the CLSI, for example, has a susceptible only breakpoint because there was no isolates where Stenotrophomonas was able to grow in the setting of sulfitoricol to even think about what would resistance look like. And when you look at the time above the MIC needed for sulfuricol to kill steno compared to other non-fermenters like Acinetobacter pseudomonas, it's much, much lower. So altogether, I would say sulfuricol is obviously very broad spectrum. It's, at least in the United States, very costly. If it was a cheaper drug, I personally think it would be the drug of choice. I mean, I think we would be comfortable using it as our drug of choice for very bad steno infections. Mm-hmm. I realize there's lots of logistic issues that makes it not feasible to use very easily, but that's my kind of pitch for why I think that Trimsulfa is probably not as effective as we might think it might be, and why a drug like sulfuricol is probably the better drug, and why the IDSA guidance suggests it as a preferred therapy.
Mm. Yeah, it's very interesting. We visited the guideline when it came out, I think we didn't do the step yet to do sulfuricol in these patients. I was very irritated when I read it that it's the first line, because we are forced to use sulfuricol quite a bit because we have many like carbapenemases and NDMs. Not many. I mean, it's not really bad yet, but there's like a significant amount, and we see emergence of resistance already in these in the gram negative bacteria. So I think it's just a matter of time until we see it in steno as well. In my opinion, I don't know. I think it's if you phrase it like this, you know, to reserve it for the really sick patients, and of course these neutropenic patients. I don't know how long the rabbits were neutropenic. So maybe the ones that survived, they came back with their cells. And usually the neutropenic patients we see from the stem cell transplantation, they have like really prolonged times. And sometimes I think, you know, no matter what you give them, they need the immune system to come up to clear the rest. Yeah. If you have something that achieves more like suppression at least, or more killing, that's definitely something they will benefit from. I think,
I agree. I mean, I think it's, again, I think it's important because we don't want to abuse this drug. You know, like, you're absolutely right. For us, too, with the NDM producers, when we, the Vim producing Pseudomonas, there's certain organisms we really don't have another option. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we do see resistance there. And even before before it was used for clinical use, we saw resistance. And certainly afterwards, there's all sorts of novel VIMs and NDMs and all sorts of mutations happening. We see quite a bit of resistance on therapy to sulfuricol for those.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it's not been described yet for Stenotrophomonas, but you're right. We don't know what, bacteria are smart. We don't know what could happen.
And in your experience, do you use, if you use sulfuricol for very sick patients with Stenotrophomonas infections, do you combine it with another agent as it is recommended in the guidance? Or?
So I personally don't. So the guidance, of course, is written by a team of people, and it's very much, even though it's not sort of a meta-analysis, right, it's very much what do we have data to support, not. I of course respect everyone on the team. My preference would have been not to say it needs another agent. The concern some people had is that all the data we have for sulfuricol and steno is PKPD animal susceptibility data. Clinical reports are limited to some cases, right? And you know, there's many things that might have caused resolution in those cases. Often the cases are with a second agent. So the other panelists felt it probably was more fair to say you should use a second agent at least until there's some improvement. In my own personal practice, when we do use sulfuricol, we use it as monotherapy, and that's what our local Johns Hopkins stewardship guidelines suggest. Those I can call guidelines, not guidance.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, thanks for the clarification, because I think this was also always like a dogma for us also, that we would need like a good reason, meaning mostly clinical data, to do dual therapy, and otherwise you would not mostly stick with monotherapy for most indications.
Yeah, I have one more question about the treatment duration, because I think it's always, you know, hard to set a stopping point, especially in these patients that are neutropenic and ongoing neutropenic and very sick. So is there any kind of number you're doing, you know, to go from the negative blood cultures or treatment days, or what's your, how do you navigate these patients?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So, you know, I think for Enterobacter alis, there's now a 4 well-known clinical trials, randomized clinical trials showing about 7 days of active treatment is generally sufficient if there's reasonable source control and all that sort of thing. The same is true for ventilator-associated pneumonia, intra-abdominal infections. I think we have good clinical trial data for Enterobacter alis on durations. The same isn't really true for non-fermenters. We do have observational studies, and some of these trials did include some Pseudomonas isolates for patients with Pseudomonas infections, but usually the numbers are quite low. My general practice has been to treat with similar durations, about 7 days. There will be some patients I might go a few days longer, but generally in the range of 7 to 10 for non-fermenters is what I do. If I can do 7, great. Sometimes with, especially an organism like Stenotrophomonas, where there's a little bit of a delay to starting active therapy, there may be a few days of inactive treatment. So I start the sort of day one on the first day of active treatment. This particular child, of course, because the baby had over a week of positive blood cultures, as you mentioned, you know, not all the ECMO circuit was changed out. We didn't know if there was some clot or something else that we weren't finding on imaging, we decided to treat more like an endovascular infection. We ended up actually treating, often for those we treat almost 6 weeks. This case, the baby was able to, there was a heart that became available at a month. So we just went for it and, you know, got the transplant and continued to treat for 2 weeks after that. Do you do something different, both of you, for non-fermenters, or how do you handle it?
No, we try to do, but it's always, you know, dependent on which department the patients are. And in Germany, I think it's a little different than in the US, that we get called, you know, from the department to go there. We can just give recommendations, and they can follow the recommendations or they can't. And usually with very sick patients, there's very much anxiousness about the patient. And so, you know, sometimes it just goes on and on. But I think maybe it's probably the same all around the world. But
is that true for you too, Till?
But also what you said about the duration, I mean, first, of course, it's highly dependent if you have like an endovascular disease, but I think like of the 2 weeks in general for an uncomplicated bloodstream infections would be the go-to length also. I think I would also estimate it with the other gram negatives that we have better data for.
In the US, in academic medical centers, the ID specialists are very much consultants. We can't, you know, we can give our suggestions, but they can listen or not listen. In community smaller hospitals, the ID consultants very much are allowed to write orders and they do the prescribing. So it's interesting, but it depends on the clinician, because sometimes ID specialists are the worst antibiotic stewards, so it doesn't always mean it's better, right?
Okay.
We in our system, I have a really great pharmacist I work with, infectious disease pharmacist, and she came up with a system in our electronic medical record. When a clinician orders a restricted drug, like, for example, sofitricol, and I will say a drug like sofitricol, these newer drugs, me or our pharmacist are the only people who can approve it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So even the infectious disease fellows or other infectious disease physicians can't approve it, because we try very hard to limit unnecessary use. But the system she developed is for other restricted drugs like meropenem. It's very nice, because if someone on the stewardship team approves it, we get to pick the duration. So That way we get control of when it stops. If they pick a drug like ceftriaxone where they don't need our permission, they can obviously go on for weeks and weeks. But
it's really unthinkable that we get to determine the length of meropenem therapy for the surgeons. That's really would be very nice.
You can borrow my pharmacist. She's also great because she put in many ways for safety in the medical record. So when it's going to be stopped within 24 hours, the primary team gets all sorts of alerts, so they know it's not suddenly disappear. Like it doesn't disappear without them knowing.
Mm-hmm. But great.
Oh, that's good.
We're not happy about it, but
great. So one other treatment option that's also mentioned in the guidance is the combination of ceftazidime, avibactam plus aztreonam, or for at least Europe, we now have a nice combination of only avibactam and aztreonam. It's called Emblaveo, and I personally have treated two patients with it and seen good results. So, and I would think that this is a combination that will also come to the US hopefully soon. So what is the role of this drug combination, also compared to sulfadrocol maybe?
Yeah, and you know, I'm actually excited about aztreonam, avibactam. They already submitted to the FDA here, so my expectation, if things go well for them, would be approved this year in the United States. They're also seeking approval in Latin America, so it will be hopefully available in large parts of the world. I'm not very familiar with other continents, what their plans are, but I like it because it's, and I'll explain them mechanistically why I think it would work, but because it's not going to be helpful very rarely, but likely, unlikely to be helpful for metallo-beta-lactamase producing pseudomonas, like Vim producing pseudomonas, for example. I do think a nice niche for this drug is an organism like Stenotrophomonas to reduce the burden on sulfadrocol, where we kind of need to preserve it for some of these other, sometimes strange non-fermenters where we don't have a lot of other options. Mm-hmm. So aztreonam, avibactam, the way it works is that with any beta-lactamase inhibitor, you know, they're two completely separate molecules. The beta-lactamase inhibitor is usually a much lower molecular weight, so it can diffuse through the outer membrane much quicker, find beta-lactamase enzymes that are a problem, inhibit them. So the beta-lactam, in this case aztreonam, can nicely make its way to its target, which happens to be penicillin binding protein 3. Now, the problem for aztreonam alone with aztreonam avibactam is Stenotrophomonas always produces a metallo-beta-lactamase. It's part of its intrinsic mechanisms of resistance. And metallo-beta-lactamase enzymes, so there's three groups of them. One group, the first group are the ones we all know, the NDM, the VIM. There's a second group that we think of in organisms like Aeromonas, and the third is the one specific for Stenotrophomonas. But this metallo-beta-lactamase, it hydrolyzes all of our traditional beta-lactams, but not aztreonam. And it's because aztreonam is a much smaller molecule, so it fits inside the groove of this enzyme, but it doesn't make good contact with the zinc, which is needed for the hydrolysis. So it's able to escape hydrolysis. So that's great. The problem for aztreonam is usually with Stenotrophomonas, it always produces another enzyme called a cephalosporinase. We call it the L2 cephalosporinase. So this enzyme, it will hydrolyze aztreonam. The aztreonam, you know, isn't hydrolyzed by the metallo-beta-lactamase. It will be hydrolyzed by the cephalosporinase. So with aztreonam avibactam, the avibactam gets into the bacteria quicker, and the avibactam binds to the cephalosporinase, inhibits its activity. So now the aztreonam still has to deal with the metallo-beta-lactamase, but it won't hydrolyze it, so it doesn't matter, and it can still make its way to its penicillin-binding protein. So I think there's susceptibility data for aztreonam avibactam against Stenotrophomonas from various parts of the world. It generally seems like from various, you know, surveillance studies, it's active against about 90% of Stenotrophomonas isolates. I think mechanistically it makes sense why it works. And there are some in vitro models showing it works. it has the same issue with sefiroquel, where there's not lots of clinical data saying, like, look how well these patients are doing with it. Personally, I have used it for stenotrophomonas. We'll use, because we don't have the drug, we use ceftazidime as trienem to mimic it with success. So my from the data available, I would say that it probably is as effective as sefiroquel for stenotrophomonas, even though I don't have any data to prove that. But again, like, you know, just with sefiroquel, it is broad spectrum. We all have problems with NDM producing Enterobacterales, and we don't want to, you know, start getting resistance to it and losing our other options. So,
yeah, that's nice. It would be so nice to see some. Do you know if there are any clinical trials or any trials on the way to evaluate these new treatments? Or
no, I think that for the company that brought Aztreonam avibactam to market did do a study where they were looking at its use against MBL producing Enterobacterales and Stenotrophomonas compared to sort of usual treatments like colistin. The numbers look good, but obviously colistin's not a great drug, so it's hard to know what to do.
Yeah.
I think because these companies do put in quite a bit of time, expertise, money into making these drugs to coming to market, they often, and I understand why, are sometimes scared to do the trial that's really needed, right? Aztreonam avibactam versus sefiroquel, maybe versus well-dosed Trimsulfa with or without a second agent or something, right? I think that usually companies are hesitant to do those kinds of trials. And I will say Shionogi, the company that brought sefiroquel to market, did do a very nice job in their clinical trial. It's called the Credible trial, where they looked specifically at carbapenem-resistant infections in pretty sick patients, comparing sefiroquel to colistin. Again, colistin, of course, isn't the best agent, but they tried to find very sick patients in the hospital with resistant organisms, the types of patients in real life we would be using this drug for. Yes, and it didn't look so good for Acinetobacter, even Pseudomonas. So after that experience, they were brave enough to use the population where it should be tested. I think it's kind of made other companies a bit scared to do that. And it's much easier to get indications for UTIs or other sort of lower risk type infections.
Absolutely.
So, so I would be surprised if that trial ever happens.
Okay. What a pity. I think I'm very well educated now on Stenotrophomonas. Thank you so much. No, really, I learned a lot.
It's the important thing for all of us as ID physicians and physicians in general and medical clinicians is, well, we try our best. Nothing is black and white. I think it's good to know the data and then come up with an approach that makes sense to you for when you might feel like you need to use these broader drugs, when it might be okay to stick with the drugs we traditionally use. And there's not a one-size-fits-all approach. I think when you write guidelines, you're a little more limited in how much you can clarify and talk through your actual approach. But I really appreciate you reaching out to discuss this. And I'm always happy to come back if there's questions about other organisms that seem to make no sense. Like, why would we say this? We get a lot of questions about Acinetobacter, so I'm always happy to discuss that. And we are actively updating the document now, and we're hoping that by the summer of this 2025, we'll have an updated document.
Great.
More data that's come out. But always welcome feedback and questions, so please tell us the things that don't quite fit or make sense, so we can think about what we might have missed or need to change.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you also for the clarification and how your personal practice in your institution differs from the guidance recommendations. That was really helpful.
So yeah, thank you, Pranita, for joining us. It was really, really great. And we give you the floor for some last, closing remarks. What do you want us or the listeners to remember or to take home?
I think for Stenotrophomonas, I would say the take home is Number one, just because it grows in a culture doesn't mean it needs treatment. So we all need to sort of think about, you know, is this, does it seem like this patient is actually sick from this organism, or might this be colonizing? And that's sometimes harder, easier said than done, because these patients are often in the ICU. They may be immunocompromised. But I think particularly when it's a respiratory culture or wound, I find it's a little easier to make the distinction. But blood, it's a little harder to ignore. It's a sterile site. And then I think coming up with stratification that makes sense to you. For us, in our local hospital, we've decided if they're critically ill, are neutropenic, but neutropenic and hemodynamically unstable, our preference is to use sulfitrochol or aztreonam avibactam. And we pick duration similar to what we would pick for the Enterobacterales. Even if they're neutropenic and they're going to stay neutropenic, we argue that, well, we have data that gram-negatives generally 7 to 14 days, so we would use the sulfitrochol, for example, for that long and not continue weeks and weeks and weeks. Hmm. But for the non-severe infections, again, sometimes you may not think they need treatment as an infectious disease specialist, but our colleagues on the other end are worried and would like something. So it's a little bit of a compromise. In cases where I feel like they probably don't need treatment and I can't win, I might do trimethoprim sulfa alone. So trimethoprim alone. I think minocycline alone as well is another reasonable option. I think levofloxacin alone could be a good option, but there are data showing that about a quarter of the time or so, resistance mm-hmm. seems to merge on treatment, so I tend to like that a little less. The guidance does mention if you use those, do them in combination. And part of that is I discussed the Trimsulfa data with you. Unfortunately, for both minocycline and levofloxacin, the issues are the same about not really achieving that one log kill. It seems to be more stasis. And there are some in vitro data. Again, it's still in vitro data suggesting when you do a combination of the two, maybe because the mechanisms are different, so Trimsulfa and Mino or Trimsulfa and Levo, that you could potentially achieve a one log kill. So again, very in vitro, not in humans. So the IDSA guidance suggests when you use these drugs, these Trimsulfa, minocycline, levofloxacin, use them in combination. In my own practice, I tend to use Trimsulfa or minocycline alone. We in our local guidance, we have a plus minus a second agent. And, you know, if it's something where they're not looking really great, but they're not incredibly sick, maybe you want to add the second agent up front and then peel back, because of course these drugs have toxicities and all the other issues. But again, it's very similarly not a one size fits all. Mm-hmm. So locally, we just say for the non-severe, a Trimsulfa plus minus minocycline levofloxacin. And then it sort of depends on the specific patient. Sorry, that was a very long summary.
Great. Okay, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.